We're here for Friends of the Black River Forest versus DNR. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is appearing by phone this morning, so we'll have to listen a little bit to see if she has a question to ask. Sometimes you can tell when she unmutes her phone and wishes to ask a question. Other than that, could you please state your appearances?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Jess Polakowski, and I'm introducing Eric Shumsky. Eric is an attorney with the Oryx Law Firm and is a member in good standing of the California and Washington, D.C. bars. Eric is admitted to this court pro hac vice and will be arguing today on behalf of Kohler Company.
All right. Has he already been admitted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for that introduction. It's my understanding you'll be arguing 15 minutes. And then appearance? Okay, and you, 10 minutes? All right, and then 30 minutes? All right, and then you reserved 5 minutes on rebuttal. Okay, with that said, let's proceed this morning. Mr. Shumsky first.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Again, I'm Eric Shumsky, and I represent Kohler, and thank you for the courtesy of letting me argue here this morning. As you know, we've made two separate arguments why the Friends don't have standing to challenge the land swap at issue here. With the Court's leave, I'm going to focus principally on the first of those reasons, namely that the Friends haven't established injury in fact, and counsel for the State is going to address the second defect, namely that plaintiffs aren't within the statute's zone of interest. So starting with injury in fact, throughout the proceedings, the Friends have emphasized the recreational and aesthetic harms that they say the construction of the golf course will cause. The problem is that the construction of the golf course wasn't at issue in these proceedings. The DNR's decision to authorize the land swap doesn't consider and it doesn't authorize any construction. Construction is far in the future, and it depends on future agency decisions to be made independently under different legal standards. Notably, that future construction is at issue in several of the other lawsuits that the Friends have brought, including their challenges to a wetlands permit and a challenge to a stormwater permit. The wetlands permit, I should note parenthetically, at this point actually stands denied. This challenge, the one here today to the land swap, is simply the wrong vehicle for making these arguments. And we know that from cases like WED1 and waste management, which make clear that the claimed injury must result directly from the challenged action. We also know this from cases like Village of Slinger, which held that there was no standing where the plaintiffs challenged an action. There it was the annexation of land, but the harm would result from a separate subsequent action, namely development. That's why in cases like Metropolitan Edison and Clapper, the U.S. Supreme Court has expressed great reluctance to endorse standing theories that rely on speculation about other intervening decisions.
Counsel, if the golf course was involved at this stage, would you?
So I want to be precise, Justice Hagedorn. It depends a little bit about what you mean by involved. If the golf course, if the construction of the golf course were actually being approved here, then matters would be totally different. But no one has alleged otherwise. The only thing that anyone has pointed to is simply that the golf course was in contemplation.
But by totally different, do you mean there would be an injury in fact? I just want to understand your position on it. If the approval of the golf course was somehow part of the same deal, would you concede an injury in fact, or is your position that would constitute an injury in fact?
So if the golf course were actually approved here, then I think the claims about construction-related harms, and sorry, just to be precise, if the construction of the golf course were approved, then yes, I think that with regard to injury in fact, the analysis would be very different for purposes of thinking about those recreational and aesthetic harms. So with that...
What if the claim counsel... I mean, I read the claim as it doesn't necessarily mean that the golf course will ever be constructed. They're still claiming a lack of ability to use the park, which violates a conservation interest. So putting aside the golf course, are you saying there's also no injury in fact, or could be no injury in fact, by someone's use of the park?
So, Justice Dowlett, they have alleged three separate types of harm. The reason I focused first on the construction-related harms is twofold. First, that has been a focus of their allegations throughout. And if you look even at their claim about lack of access, that's tied to the construction of a fence. So that's one reason. The other reason we thought it important to at least initially start by focusing on the construction-related harms is that's what really gave rise to the signal legal defect in what the Court of Appeals did here that I suspect is part of what led to the grant of review. And that relates to the legal standard for causation in particular. And if you look precisely at the way that the Court of Appeals talked about this, it's pretty clear that the Court of Appeals embraced a notion of pure but-for causation. And we see that in part from the language of strains the imagination that shows up four different times in the court's decision, but also elsewhere. We see that Kohler talks, or that the opinion talks about the fact that Kohler, quote, began the process of obtaining permits. It also says, and this is at page 13 of the appendix, the land exchange has made those intervening steps possible. Again, that's sort of the rawest form of but-for causation, and that's contrary to this court's precedents. Fox is very clear in relying on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Metropolitan Edison, which explicitly says you have to have proximate cause in order to establish causation and injury in fact, and that's 460 U.S. at 774. And again, the language of this court repeatedly, discussion of a direct result or a close causal relationship, is the language of proximate causation.
Counsel, if I were to tell you that Wisconsin doesn't use proximate cause, we don't have that in our common law anymore, we have simply a cause, would that change your argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that whatever label we put on it, and authorities like Prosser have candidly admitted that proximate cause can be a bit of a slippery term. If you look at Fox and at WED1, they're using language where, whether you call it proximate cause or something else, it's very clear that there must be a causal link that isn't just mere but-for cause, imagining something that someday could result. And regardless, again, setting aside this question of terminology, there's this idea of intervening cause. What we have here are these independent agency decisions that intervene and break the chain of causation, and I'm not aware of anything in Wisconsin law that would disregard those basic precepts.
So let me ask you this, counsel. These two decisions happen back-to-back, right? So first the land is decided not to be a conservation interest, and then it's conveyed, right? So the two different decisions. At what point could someone make such a challenge that you're saying they could potentially make? They're not as separate as you would like them to appear, I guess is my point. So at what point could someone challenge a conservation interest as an injury? In fact, what's your position on that? And then if they can, when were they supposed to do that? There wasn't a point in time in which that could have happened, correct?
So, Justice Dowlett, let me answer it in a couple of parts. So, first of all, in the abstract, certainly environmental-related harms are cognizable harms, and that was the point I was making about this simply being the wrong proceeding. in the lawsuit that they have brought challenging the issuance, initially the issuance and now the revocation of the wetlands permit, that's a classic case for this. That involves conservation-related harms, and it is directly related to the construction. And so our point here is not that they will never have standing, that there is no proceeding in which they will have standing. They will have their day in court. In fact, they are having many days in court. There are something like 5 separate lawsuits involving this single project. But I do want to make sure to answer the question you started off by asking about this access question, which I think is wrapped in Your Honor's second question about the multiple steps here. It is not an accident that their focus has been on the land swap, on the second of those 2 decisions. And I'll point, Your Honor, just briefly to the prayer for relief, which is on page 29 of the appendix. And you can see that the swap is really the thing that they were focused on. And that's not an accident. The initial decision to take the land out of the state park, if that's the thing they meant to be challenging, then they have an even bigger zone of interest problem than the one that the state will talk about in a moment, because there is no statute that they've pointed to that gives rise to a right of action, much less any cognizable standards for taking land out of the park. The thing that they've focused on here is Section 2315, and of course that's about selling land outside of parks. So to circle back to your question, this is not a hyper-technicality about the thing that they were focused on. I think our view is that they did it quite deliberately when they were arguing this, and there's a good underlying legal reason for that. On this question about lack of access, I do just want to highlight the circuit court's explanation of this, because I think that the circuit court put this candidly better than I could, and I think it's exactly why there's a significant standing problem on this access question, separate from the construction-related harms that I started with. So this is what the circuit court said. The petitioners do not plead how the agreement itself deprives them use of the land in the park. The petitioners do not establish that land swap documents prohibit access to the property in question. The agreement only provides for the change in ownership possession. The petitioners have not alleged that Kohler placed restrictions on access to the land in question in the land swap agreements. No structures or obstructions have been placed on the land, and construction has not been fully approved or begun on the property. All there is here, if you set aside the hook to the fencing that I alluded to, all that there is here is this sort of bare allegation that's carried forward into the appellate briefing saying we won't be able to get access. And this court has been clear in cases like Data Key Partners that plaintiffs have to allege facts plausibly suggesting that they're entitled to relief, and there's just nothing like that here. They haven't argued that they would have had access to the state land once it was outside of the park. They just assert it. They haven't alleged that Kohler is restricting access, or more specifically, that it's going to restrict the land any more than the state might have done. Let me turn just briefly to the third theory of injury that that the friends have alleged. And this is what I think we can sort of call colloquially procedural harm. They've alleged candidly, I'm a little unclear on what the precise theory is, but the theory is that somehow procedures were not followed and that gives rise to cognizable harm here. And I would just say a couple of things about that. First, this court has never recognized that as a standalone theory of harm. Now, to be clear, it does exist in the federal courts, but we haven't found anything, and the other side hasn't cited anything in Wisconsin law as recognizing that theory for the first time. And certainly there has been no authority extending that kind of theory to regulatory harms as opposed to statutory harms. But even beyond that, and maybe more fundamentally, Even the courts that do recognize procedural injury as a form of injury in fact, they require that you have some kind of underlying concrete interest that's harmed. And so, in essence, this notion of procedural harm ends up being a derivative cause of action or a parasitic claim. It just rides along with the underlying harms that you have to show elsewhere. And that being so, that doesn't actually get the friends a new theory of harm here. It just means they have to establish one of these other forms of harm that they've elsewhere.
So, counsel, in Data Key Partners and some of these other cases, standing was not the issue. The issue was failure to state a claim. Could we find that there is standing, but still on the merits, the claim itself fail? I mean, they're two totally separate things, right?
But to be sure, Your Honor, a party has to make out standing at every step of the proceedings, and so it's certainly possible that their standing claim would fail later or that their claim would fail on the merits later. But you also have to plausibly allege a claim, and that should be no less true for standing than it is for any of the other key elements that one has to establish.
Even though in Wisconsin we broadly construe standing.
I think, Your Honor, that that's generally true. The federal courts also broadly construe standing, but that, I mean, broad doesn't mean infinite, and one still does have to scrutinize the pleadings. And here, again, going back to where I started, I know I'm almost at the end of my time, with regard to this question of intervening cause in particular, that the construction-related harms, the recreational and aesthetic harms, caused by the proceeding that they're challenging here.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Johnson-Karp.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case presents the Court a clear opportunity to clarify Wisconsin's zone of interest test and to make clear that that test is textually driven and not, as the Court of Appeals held, one that focuses on how a statute might be characterized or whether a statute could be called environmental in nature. The zone test is a textually driven inquiry that requires courts to analyze whether there are any indicia in the text of the statute at issue that statute is one which the legislature authorized plaintiffs like this to bring claims like this. In 2315, we have no such textual indication that the legislature was authorizing claims like the Friends against the board's decision here.
Counsel, is it your position that there needs to be a specific statute that says you can sue over this? Is that your claim?
No, Your Honor, no. And I'd like to distinguish between sort of the broader cause of action that 227 provides. So 227.52 says anybody with substantial interests can bring a 227 action. The zone of interest inquiry looks at that underlying statute on which they would claim their interest. And no, that statute doesn't need to say an individual person like this plaintiff can bring a suit. Instead, what we look at are the textual indicators that this statute is one that the legislature was providing rights for these plaintiffs and contemplating that these plaintiffs would enforce those rights in court.
Can you, as succinctly as you can, put a little teeth on that for me? Can you give me a holding statement that you would like us to say about this?
Wisconsin's zone of interest inquiry is a textually driven inquiry that focuses on fairly discernible textual evidence that the legislature authorized these plaintiffs to challenge this decision. And I think the inquiry, like all inquiries in statutory interpretation, starts with the text. And here we have three indications in X.
Is your zone of interest inquiry, is this equivalent to substantial interest in the statute? Do you think that's what that's referring to? One of the things that I find perplexing about this case is to some extent how some of the language in our cases doesn't utilize in much sense the statutory language. And I really care what the statute says. So is the zone of interest inquiry the substantial interests inquiry under the statute?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
So one of the things that I did in preparing for this case is, because I didn't really understand what substantial interest means. I have some theory behind it, but pulled out a little bit of legislative history on substantial interests in when it came about. And basically, you know, the statute used to say legal rights, obligations, and duties. And the legislature then removed that language. It was vetoed by Governor Lucey. Governor Lucey says this is going to broaden, suits that can be brought against the state. Legislature overrides the veto. And in the Legislative Council memo, they talk about substantial interests as, I'll read you the language. Here's what they say, and I want to make sense of this text. They say, throughout this revision, the words legal rights, duties, or privileges have been deleted and the word substantial interest inserted instead. Also, the word directly is replaced with adversely. The principal reason is explained in this note relating to the definition of party and person aggrieved. And then says the use of the word substantial interest is intended to broaden, not lessen, the definition case and other phrases to which the situational interest or substantial interest language relates. In this section, it is intended that a low threshold of qualification for participation in a contested case be established, but that some interest, however slight, must be involved. A legal right, duty, or privilege will always be a substantial interest, and then substantial as an adjective means something worthwhile as distinguished from something without value or merely nominal. We obviously want to interpret the text. We usually don't go to legislative history unless it's ambiguous. I don't really know what substantial interest means, but could you help me align that language in at least some of this history, and if it's wrong, that I stand to be corrected, but with how that might relate to what you're putting forward as a theory or test for us to apply here?
Well, I think that the substantial interest that we have to look at here, or I should say whether there is a substantial interest, rests on the text of 2315. And the question then is, what does the text of 2315 do? What interests are created there? And the text there provides no indication that it's creating private interests.
Well, I agree it doesn't. So let's just say that it doesn't. But substantial interest does seem to be broader than the language it used to be there, legal rights, duties, or privileges. So at what sense does that language require us to look not just at the text of 2315 and say whether that creates a right, but whether there's some rights derivative from that or beyond that adversely affect your substantial interests?
Well, I think for purposes of this case, Your Honor, the court doesn't need to define the entire universe of what qualifies as a substantial interest. I think it's sufficient to resolve this case to say that what 2315 does not create substantial interests in private challengers like this.
Counsel, is that because that is the statute they say was misused by the DNR in regard to the land transfer out of the park?
It's what they say, and it's also just reasonably construing their pleading, the only statute that really applies to this decision here. They've cited some statutes about legislative policy mm-hmm. and general oversight of parks, but this is really the only statute that relates to their pleading, which is a challenge to the decision to transfer land, and that's clearly contemplated within 2315.
Okay. So if 999 acres of the 1,000 acres was found by the DNR to not be in conservation interest anymore, Are you saying that no one who enjoys that park could challenge that decision?
Your Honor, under 2315, that is what the legislature has said. That
right, but I'm having a hard time because I hear you saying two things, and I think this is what my colleague, Justice Hagedorn, was trying to ask. If you don't have to tie it to a statute, and I heard you say, or at least I heard your counsel that previously argued say, that there is an environmental interest is cognizable. So, and we just heard the history about the difference between having to have a legal claim, a legal right or duty versus a substantial interest. So why does it have to be tied to 2315 per se the way you're reading it?
Well, I think here that's, as I said, the only statute that covers this situation. In other environmental contexts, WEPA would very likely be implicated. Plaintiffs, or rather petitioners, haven't pleaded a WEPA claim, and WEPA is often the vehicle by which these types of environmental harms are addressed.
Counsel, let's say a permit is given to, a CAFO or something like that, right, and you have a neighbor whose house value is going to, fall in half because of that, and do they need to point to a specific statute that gives them a right to say that, or would they plausibly fall within substantial interests?
I believe that typically the types of permit challenges have recognized that those types of neighbor interests, or those who would in fact be somehow affected by the grant of that permit, are that their substantial interests are affected by the grant of that permit. And
Test that you'd propose, what you're asking us to say is those that they have that right because a text gives neighbors who are affected by a permit that does something negative to them, that's what we would need to look for, is find that other another textual hook.
That is sometimes the case in permit statutes. There are occasions when nearby entities are given a right to participate. But we're not saying that that's required to establish substantial interest. And I'd like to make clear that the argument here is not a severe narrowing of the substantial interest test. We're focusing only on the text of this statute that contemplates gubernatorial approval that implicates this necessity standard, which is to say the board determined whether it's necessary for the state's purposes, and that contemplated a complex interaction. So it's those three textual indicators, and I see my time is up, so I'll stop there. But we've discussed those in the brief, and we believe that those indicators are sufficient to establish that the Friends are not within the zone of 2315's interests.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Attorney Westerberg.
May it please the Court. My name again is Krista Westerberg, and with me is Leslie Freehill. We represent the Friends of the Black River Forest and Claudia Bricks. This is a standing case under Wisconsin Statute Chapter 227 and the right of people to simply get into court and challenge agency overreach. Just this summer in the City of Mayville case, the court reaffirmed the principle that standing under Chapter 227 should be liberally. Yet the Department of Natural Resources and Kohler take a narrow and hyper-technical view of standing that would immunize agencies from judicial review and keep injured people out of court. But standing is not supposed to be hard, certainly not harder than the merits. It's a threshold inquiry.
Counsel, is it part of your argument that WISSTAT Section 2315 was violated by the transfer of this land out of the park?
Yes, Justice Robinsack, that and the regulations that implement Wisconsin Statute Chapter 23 and 27. And we've identified some of those regulations in our briefs. It would be at Wisconsin Administrative Code, chapters NR1 and NR44. Mm-hmm.
Can I state that slightly differently just to make sure I'm understanding your argument? When I read through this, I thought there are two things that happened here. First, there is a parcel of land that was removed from the park, albeit I think it happened on the same day and within a short period of time from each other, but there were two distinct actions: removal from the state park and then later the transfer to Kohler in the land swap, right? Are you challenging both things?
Yes, Chief Justice Ziegler, we are. And I can elaborate on that if you would like.
I would in a second. Is there a statutory basis upon which you rely for each part of this analysis? The removal from the state park, I think, is different, potentially, from the transfer swap with Kohler.
Yes, it would be as both part of the statutes and the rules. And as to the transfer of land from within the state park to outside of the state park, we point to NR 44.04 sub 9, which says the department can only carry out those management activities that have been approved in the master plan. And this activity was not approved in the master plan for the property. The department had initiated the master planning process, which involves significant study and public involvement, but it hadn't finished it to consider this very issue about whether the land could be modified and transferred out of the park.
Council, okay. Master plans are available for every state park. That's part of the state system for regulating those parks. But my view, at least everything I've read, tells me they're never finished. They change all the time because the needs that the DNR perceives as it manages these parks change all the time. So I was a little confused by your argument saying the transfer was bad because it was done before the master plan for this park was finished.
After you answer that, could I get an answer to the statute specifically that you're relying on for each, the removal and the transfer? But I was going to ask the same thing anyway.
Okay.
So great minds think alike, I guess.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, master plans are designed to be revised, I think, every 15 years in the code. But that doesn't mean that they are not to be followed, of course, and that the public, you know, in recognition of the fact that state parks are such a public resource and are set aside for the benefit of the public, it says so right in Statute 27.01 sub 1, that the purpose of state parks is for public recreation and public education in conservation and nature study. So it makes sense that there would also be a public process to change a master plan and make such a significant change as this one, which did not just take land out of the park, public land out of the park, and transfer it to a private interest, but also to impact those remaining parts of the park that remain, with a large maintenance facility where there hadn't been one, and a road going through the park that would carry traffic to the golf course. So those are major changes that would have needed to be approved in the master plan. Now, as to this, Chief Justice Ziegler, the statutes and the rules, I mentioned 27.01 sub 1 before.
Just if you can, if you can chunk it out for me, the removal and the statutes that deal with that claim, moving the property out of the park, and then what statutes support that claim, and then transfer to Kohler, and what statutes support that claim.
Okay. If I can start from the rules and work backwards to the statutes, the rules we're looking at are NR 1.47 sub 1 and sub 2. Sub 1 says land within state parks cannot be sold or otherwise disposed of. Land outside of the state park boundaries but still belonging to the department cannot be conveyed unless they are no longer needed for the state's conservation purposes and then according to a specific taxonomy, first to local governments and then lastly to other interests. Also, NR 1.60 That says that parkland should be managed in accordance with the master plan, and it specifically says in a note to NR 1.60 sub 3 that state parks must be managed in accordance with 27.01, which again is the statute I mentioned before. I would also point to, and other provisions of 1.60 are applicable as well, NR 44.04 sub 9, which I think I mentioned before as well.
These are all for removal, what you're citing to me. I'm making notes. I've got removal, and now I want to write down the statutes you're relying on. And then I've got transfer, and I want to write down the statutes that you're relying on. So all the things you've cited so far for the objection to the removal out of the state park.
I would say those are both removal and sale.
Okay.
But I will be honest, I have not actually found a part of the statutes that authorizes removal of land from a state park. If you look throughout chapters 23 and if you look at chapters 27, there's nothing that specifically says the department can dispose of land within a state park boundaries. The statutes speak extensively of consolidating ownership in state parks and adding to state parks and trying to keep to add to protect state parks. So you see that in 23.09 sub 1 and sub 2 and 23.11 sub 1, the DNR shall have and take the general care, protection, and supervision of state parks, not fragmentation, which is what happened here.
Council, can I just want to get to the nub of this a little bit more.
Did you give me everything you've got for the statutes that deal with removal and the statutes that deal with transfer? I'm sorry, Justice.
No, that's great. I thought she was.
We're never getting there if I can't just quick get an answer. Here's my support. Here's the statute. Here's the provision. I'm just trying to nail it down because it seemed like a. It was a moving target for me as I was studying this, and I was trying to figure out what is this, a standing case, a failure to state claim upon which relief can be granted, kind of both, where's the claim, what's it lying, and does it survive, and I was trying to figure these things out. So if you have an answer for me, can you just quick give me the statutes?
The last one would just be 23.15, which you know, the parties have already talked about. And then underlying both chapters 23 and 27 is the fact that the legislature in both chapters has specifically authorized the department to promulgate rules to implement those chapters. So that's why we, one reason we pointed to the rules in this case.
Okay, thank you.
I enjoy visiting Governor Dodge State Park, but I haven't been there in a number of years. Suppose they wanted to take a quarter acre and they sold it or were changing it in some way. Maybe it was a part or next to my favorite trail. Do I have standing to sue the state over that? Assuming, again, I can allege, I understand you're alleging, textual or rule violations that the action was otherwise illegal, but do I have standing to sue, assuming I had similar statutory grounds that DNR might have acted, illegally?
Yes, Justice Hagedorn, I believe so. Our position is that users of a state park, like the users of the park in Sierra Club versus Morton, should have standing to challenge actions that harm their recreational and conservational and aesthetic interests in using that state park or their access to land in that state park. Under the zone of interest part of that, we believe that those interests are within the zone of interest of the statutes and rules I mentioned regarding state parks. Now, whether those rules were actually violated, of course, is an issue for the merits.
Right. So essentially, your position is that, anyone who has some enjoyment of something to do with the environment that they think is impacted, that would be enough to get them into court. That's an adverse impact on their adverse effect of their substantial interests, to use the language of the statute.
Yes, I mean, of course there are. You would have to show you use the park enough. So the illustration in the American Bottom Conservancy case we've cited in our brief from Judge Posner was that, well, if you're a California environmental group who's never visited the park, you're probably not going to have standing because you haven't been injured. But in this case, or in case where you have frequent users of the park and neighbors of the park, yes, we believe you would have standing.
Okay. So can you distinguish then standing from failure to state a claim?
Standing is the only action, the only issue that's been alleged here, and I think it is getting a little confused with the failure to state a claim and, you know, has the statute been violated, which again is an issue for the merits. Wisconsin statute section 27. I believe 56 is what authorizes a motion to dismiss a chapter 227 case for standing because the petitioner has not sufficiently alleged facts showing that they are aggrieved. That's all we are here for.
Can you have standing for a non-existent claim?
Well, I think that's a hypothetical question here because we have alleged a claim. But yeah, no, our claim is based on our cause of action is under chapter 227 and 227.52 and 53 specifically. That does loop in whether the agency actually violated the law, but that I think is a question again for the merits.
So I just want to press on this one more time, sorry. It seems maybe this is unique to, you know, just environmental litigation, but your position, you know, is that essentially 227.52, that it creates a wide window for almost anybody to challenge almost any action of state government that they think would adversely impact their enjoyment of the environment, which, boy, that could be almost a limitless number of things that I could think about. I mean, that's a pretty wide. Now, granted, in Wisconsin, we have, you know, taxpayer standing, which is a very low hurdle, and so maybe you're arguing that something similar applies here in the environment, but it strikes me as a very big net.
That is what Chapter 227 says. It is rather broadly phrased that in 227.52, anyone with substantial interests that have been injured either affirmatively or negatively by agency action or inaction can get into court, and also in 227.53 that you need to be aggrieved. But of course, that has been narrowed somewhat, I think, by the courts.
Substantial interest, though, does that have any meaning? I mean, it almost seems like you're saying anything at all. I mean, granted, even what I read earlier, you know, language that was used by the legislature. So they're drafting the substantial, again, this isn't in the statutes, but this is their memo. Substantial as an adjective means something worthwhile as distinguished from something without value or merely nominal. Are there environmental claims or interests that might be nominal? My enjoyment in a certain trail or a certain, you know, wildlife, maybe not. I'm just asking, are there any limits to that? Does it have any teeth in this area that's relevant? Because I want to make sure we're giving full effect to that language of the statute.
Absolutely. Yeah, as I was saying, I think it goes back to the answer before about you do have to have, you know, show some use of the resource. You know, the friends in this case have alleged that they are users of the resource and not just occasional users, but they as often as once a week use the resource. I would also point out that this court has emphasized in cases like Fox and in cases like Milwaukee Brewers that people who live in the area, which the petitioners in this case do, or the friends in this case do, and who use the affected area are the ones who have standing. It's a trifling interest, or as your research uncovered, Justice Hagedorn, even however slight, it is still an interest just to get into court and challenge agency action. I think the point is to make it possible for people to challenge agencies who have overreached and not followed the law.
Counselor, would you please address Aquatech's requirement that the injury suffered must be peculiar to the plaintiff and not sustained by the public in general in regard to the injuries that you've alleged?
Certainly, Justice Rogenczak. Aquatech has, of course, that was not a 227 case. I don't believe so. Let me just make that comment right off the bat. But we believe the petitioners in this case, the Friends, have alleged injuries that are peculiar to them under this court's standing jurisprudence and similar jurisprudence from the U.S. Supreme Court because they are users of the resource at issue and have recreational and conservational and aesthetic injuries. They're really perfectly in line with those precedents, and because they are users of the resource, they have shown the injuries are peculiar to them.
What if I go around and use a variety of state parks because I like to hike, which I do, and I've been to this park only once? Would I be able to bring the same claim that the plaintiffs you represent brought here?
I would say be a hypothetical, and the facts of this case aren't aligning with that. So in this case, we have people who do use the park on a more regular basis. And I know that the department has made sort of this floodgates argument that if we allow the claim in this case, and Kohler has too to some extent, we're opening the floodgates to challenges of land disposal all over the place. I would note that only two people challenged the land transaction here.
But, you haven't addressed my question, which was how are the injuries that you claim not generalized injuries of the public at large? Because a lot of people use the parks. You don't have to live near them to use them.
That's true, Justice Rogenczak, and I think that's addressed in Sierra Club versus Morton and other U.S. Supreme Court cases that frankly say just because many people may have an injury doesn't mean it's any less of an injury.
But Aquatech is our case. It's our case in Wisconsin, and that's what I kind of wanted you to focus on now.
Sure. Well, like as I said before, it does say that injuries need to be peculiar to the petitioners, and we have alleged that these injuries are peculiar to the petitioners, just because other people may also...
It also says, and not sustained by the public in general. That's the other part of the quote that you're...
And I think the public in general in that case would refer to people who do not use the park. And that's what distinguishes the Friends in this case from... people who would not have standing.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Westbrook, I want to ask you about the golf course. Mr. Shumsky started out his argument talking about the golf course, and I think he conceded to a question that Justice Hagedorn asked. Justice Hagedorn asked if the golf course were involved, where there'd be an injury in fact. He said yes, but he said, look, the golf course hasn't been permitted yet. It hasn't been authorized yet. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to all of that. And if the, let me ask the opposite, maybe perhaps it's the converse of what Justice Hagedorn asked. If there were no golf course involved here, does that make a difference in your argument?
I'll start with that last question first, Justice Karofsky. So we have alleged five separate injuries, two of which are not, as the Kohler calls it, construction-related. One is the loss of access to state park land, and then the other is this procedural injury because the Friends were deprived of the opportunity to participate in the master planning process, which should have occurred before this decision was made. So as to those, and then I'll get to the construction-related injuries in a minute. Those injuries are not hypothetical or are conjectural. Even Kohler doesn't say so. They are not generalized, which is the argument they make in their brief, and we've just talked about that. I would analogize to the City of Mayville case because the court here found that the city had standing to challenge a department decision approving this cooperative agreement between a town and a village, partially because the city would have otherwise had rights to take actions related to that land. Another thing I would point out as to the procedural injury.
Those rights are statutory rights in city.
Correct.
Asia.
Correct. And the Friends have statutory rights as members of the public to use state parkland. Another thing I would point to is in our 1.61 sub 1, which says the department shall keep open all land to traditional outdoor activities, whether it's within a state park or without a state park, unless a statute or rule says otherwise. So that provision, I think, also affords members of the public the right to use this property as well. As to the procedural injury, I'd also just note that under WEPA, WEPA is a procedural statute. So people who have alleged a violation of WEPA are essentially alleging a procedural injury. And as to those construction-related injuries, Kohler obtained the right to exclude. So I don't think it matters, to answer your question, Justice Karofsky, that they needed to have construct the golf course for those injuries to occur, because they could exclude the public from the property right away as a result of that decision.
Has Kohler excluded the public from the property? Is that alleged in your petition anywhere?
That is not in the record. There are three construction-related injuries that will occur when Kohler's maintenance facility and road are erected. There are aesthetic impacts. There's the loss of habitat for wildlife and plants the Friends enjoy. And there is impacts from increased traffic and noise, which was explicitly recognized as an injury in the Milwaukee Brewers case.
Have any of those injuries actually happened at this point in time?
That also is not in the record, but no.
Okay, thank you.
But nonetheless, those injuries are not hypothetical or conjectural, Justice Bradley, because the department and Kohler say the very purpose of the decision here is for the construction of the golf course, the road, and the maintenance facility. It's not an unknown what will happen to the land. It's not as if the department gave the land to Kohler and Kohler said, we don't know what we're going to do with it.
There are other lawsuits pending, though, challenging the construction of the golf course, or challenging decisions that would be prerequisites to the construction of the golf course. So it's far from a foregone conclusion that the golf course will in fact be constructed, correct?
That's true that those other actions are out there and that the course may not ultimately be constructed, but I don't think that that precludes a finding of an injury, including under this court's recent decision in Applegate Bader Farms, which reaffirmed the principle that an injury exists even that might be remote in time or that might not come until the end of a series of events. So that's precisely the case here with the golf course. And Fox recognizes that an injury can just be threatened. It doesn't have to be actual. And that's repeated in other cases. Another thing I would point this court to, which I think is a very comparable analysis, is in American Bottom Conservancy. There, the plaintiffs were, it's an environmental group who was opposing the construction of a landfill a half a mile from a state park that they used. And that landfill needed a number of approvals, but the only approval being challenged in that case was a wetland destruction permit. And Judge Posner found that the plaintiffs had standing even though those other permits were still pending and may not be approved. And I think the pertinent language he uses is, if American Bottom Conservancy can prevent the wetlands destruction by knocking out the Corps of Engineers permit, there will be no North Milam landfill, and so a judgment in the plaintiff's favor in the present lawsuit would eliminate a probable injury from a landfill.
But here we have just a land swap decision. This lawsuit does not involve any permits that Kohler might be seeking to obtain to do anything with the land, correct?
I think based on the face of the land swap documents themselves, it's clear that the purpose of the decision was for this golf course. That's what they say. And I think we can take their word for it. And in American Bottom Conservancy, what Judge Posner says is that the fact that they are continuing to prosecute these permits makes the injury probable.
Right, but this isn't a permitting case. This is simply the land swap case. I guess what I'm getting at is the analysis that the circuit court undertook, Judge Stengel. It, basically, I'd sum it up by saying there's a break in the link that your clients are trying to make between the land swap decision itself and any injuries that they could incur in the future, that they're simply not connected to the land swap decision itself, that they may be connected to other decisions that have been or may be made in the chain, but here we're just looking at the land swap decision. So could you address that analysis of the circuit court and tell me why you think Judge Stengel got it wrong?
Because I think his decision failed to acknowledge that this decision that was challenged was a necessary step. And I think the Clean Wisconsin amicus brief addresses this well. It says if something is necessary, that doesn't mean it has to be sufficient, but it has to be necessary, and that is enough for standing, and that's supported by cases like Wisconsin's Environmental Decade and Applegate Bader Farms, which both say this can be one step in the chain.
But you've had some questions about whether we're looking. I think obviously the issue is standing, but that is connected to whether a claim is stated, because in order to have standing, you have to allege an injury that is linked to the decision, the agency decision that you're challenging. And while this decision could theoretically set in motion Kohler's plans that could in the future injure your clients, in and of itself, the land swap cannot injure your clients, or at least you haven't alleged it in the petition. You've alleged other things that Kohler might do or other things the DNR might do as far as approving permits. All of that could certainly cause an injury in fact, but I think what Judge Stengel is getting at is that this decision in and of itself does not injure your clients in any way, and that's what I wanted you to address.
Thank you. Yes, so there are the two injuries that are not construction-related, so we think those give us standing right off the bat. But the other, as to those three construction-related injuries, I think this Court's precedents confirm that they don't need to be immediate, they don't need to be actual, and if we didn't get to challenge this decision now, there's no other opportunity for us to do so, because we had to have challenged this within 30 days under Chapter 227.53, I think sub 1, you have to challenge a decision within 30 days of that decision being served. And the petitioners would have had no other opportunity to challenge the offloading of state land if they didn't do it now. But also, based on the face of the documents that the department and Kohler prepared, it's also clear that this approval will cause other injuries, which are those aesthetic and recreational and conservational injuries.
But if Kohler abandoned its plans to construct the golf course or otherwise impeded, let's say the permits, they can't get the permits, some of the other challenges are successful, you would agree then, and if Kohler did not exclude the public from access to the land, then your clients would have suffered no injury in the future, correct?
If they did not exclude people from the land and if the land was still available for people to use, but they still reserved a right in the future to exclude? I'm not sure, honestly. But I think that they probably, in this case, it is clear that they do have an injury because the land is being conveyed and because of those aesthetic, conservational, and recreational injuries that the plan documents themselves contemplate. I would say, in closing, I see my time is up. We would just ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals and remand this matter to the Circuit Court for a decision on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Shumsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start by focusing, if I can, on Justice Hagedorn, your questions about zone of interest and then time permitting, turn to the cluster of questions Chief Justice Ziegler and Justice Rogenczyk, you were asking about the movement of the land out of the state park. On zone of interest, Justice Hagedorn, I would just point you again, and I know the briefing discussed this at length, to Shaniqua and Outagamie. Those do a lot of work, Shaniqua in particular, in explaining how to go about thinking about zone of interest. And Shaniqua specifically distinguishes Aquatech and says, all right, in Aquatech, there was standing, the zone of interest was satisfied, because there was this carefully defined set of rules for tiered distribution of land. That's actually just like what there was in WED1, where, again, there was this priority about distribution of gas. And what the courts in those cases, in WED1 and Aquatech, said in finding standing is, it's pretty clear from the way that structure is set up that individual members of the public have enforceable rights. But here, we're just like in Shaniqua or Outagamie, where there's absolutely nothing like that. We have, as counsel for the state was saying, this bare statement of necessity, which is exactly the opposite of that set of enforceable rights that you can work with in identifying a zone of interest. The Chief Justice and Justice Rogenczyk were asking about the two-step process here and drilling down on what precisely the injury was. And I think it's worth being very crisp about what the other side's response on this is. So first they point to NR 44, but again, that is bare procedural injury. That's the point I was making at the end of my opening remarks. That doesn't get you anything unless you can point to some other concrete injury. And Justice Rogenczyk, as you were pointing out, the planning process is evergreen, and the idea that gives rise to causes of action would be sort of endless. Also related to NR 44, they say that they weren't allowed to participate. But on the contrary, the undisputed facts here show that, in fact, they participated, and they said they did. That's in the appendix at page 43, among other places. The balance of the response has a real distinct feeling of backfill, and I think it's really indicative of how little there is here on this notion of harm. So my friend on the other side cited NR 1.60. That is literally the first that any of us has heard about that in these proceedings. That regulation is not cited in any of the briefs. It wasn't asserted as a basis. It is way, way, way too late in the day for that to be the theory of injury here. There was also a suggestion that there is no statutory basis at all to remove land from a state park. If that were true, that would be a brand new claim under Section 227, and it also is something that never was raised, never was pressed, and certainly doesn't even appear in the appellate briefing here. Again, there is no fair world in which that today, for the first time, should be a theory of standing. The last point that I would just make, and maybe in closing, Justice Hagedorn, you asked or perhaps even expressed a bit of concern about the endless breadth of environmental standing here, if all you have to do is say, as Justice Rogenczyk asked, you know, I went on a trail once. That is precisely why it's critical to take the causation inquiry seriously. That is precisely why zone of interest matters, because unless these critical boundaries are in place, then anyone can sue for anything that they just don't like. And that's exactly what the state has been pointing out with regard to 23.15. It has no administrable criteria. It doesn't identify beneficiaries. On the contrary, it says that if anyone is meant to police this, it's the governor. The legislature itself said, and this is pretty important both textually and thinking structurally about the statute, the legislature said, this is a matter for the governor's approval, and the only thing, the only sort of criterion here is just a bare determination of necessity. And Outagamie went so far as to say that if that's what you've got, it may not even be a justiciable question for the courts at all. So, Justice Hagedorn, I would say those are the places we need to look, and that's why the arguments that we've been making today matter so much. So I see that I'm out of time. Unless there are any further questions, we would simply urge that Judge Stengel had this exactly right and that there is no standing here.
All right. Thank you very much. Very interesting case. Good briefing. Thank you for your arguments today. The court will recess now, and we will reconvene for the second case of the morning shortly. Thank you.